Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of the Just a Freedom Show. I am your darling and dashing host, Push Nevada, coming to you live from Tempe, Arizona. But before I start the show, I want to send a couple of shout-outs. I was in Detroit the past weekend doing a couple of book events and celebrating my birthday, and I got to send a shout-out to my best friend, LJ, Cheryl Williams, the bartender at Ambience, Stephanie, Adra, Tracy, and her husband, Michael, Alicia Ware, Austin, Radina, Marie, Lyrical Love, Sean, Karen Dabney, Nina Simone, and Maya Bass, especially, because there I am, again, as always, rushing to the airport, and she saved my life, and she knows the story behind that. Thank you very much. Okay, let's welcome my new guest to the show today, Meredith A. Ellis, a doctoral student in the Department of Anthropology at Syracuse University. I believe she's here to talk a little bit about her research, which I believe involves Louis Tappan, very important historical figure. And she's here to talk a little bit about bioarchaeology, I believe. Meredith, are you there?
I am. Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great. I have a few questions here because I've heard of the word bio and I've heard of the word archaeology, but never mixed together, put together, really. What is bioarchaeology?
Sure.
I'm sorry.
Sure. You might know it by some of the other names it goes by, which is physical anthropology or forensic anthropology. And basically what I do is I study skeletal remains from archaeology sites. So when the archaeologists go out and dig a site and hit human remains, I come in and do the analysis myself and other folks like me. And primarily I work on remains from archaeology sites, but other individuals who work in this field do forensic cases on modern day issues.
Okay, so let me get this right. You're the person who come in and analyze the bones for, authenticity to sale?
No, we analyze them to find out all that we can about the individuals while they were alive. So we
can look at the
remains and talk about, you know, how old were they when they died? Was it a male or female?
Wow.
What sort of activities they did? What diseases they had? What their lifestyle was like? And so we put that information together, which then gets added to the whole picture of whatever the archaeology site is and what life was like there.
Yeah, okay. Wow. Yeah, I've definitely heard of that before. I guess I've watched enough of those detective forensic file
That's
shows.
Right.
And,
Sure.
To get enough of, which is really fascinating because they'll be like, the last sandwich this brother ate 30 years ago was a bologna, you know. And I'm like, wow, how do they do that, you know?
It's an amazing field. There's so much that we can learn just from looking at bone. I think what a lot of people don't realize is that bone is a living tissue just like any other part of the body. And that means as we live, bone cells are constantly dying and being regenerated, and those bone cells act like a record for what's going on in our lives around us. So what we eat, what activities we're doing, all gets recorded in the skeleton. And with enough science and training, we can read that skeleton and learn all about the individual during his or her life.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the first instances in which I really took a critical look at the whole anthropological field, or the field of anthropology, and there are many extensions, was during my undergraduate studies as a history major, and we're studying the slave community, and somehow, some way, they talked about the anthropology of that study, where slaves, the muscle, they could tell, they could look at the bone and tell how hard they had worked, for instance, and whether how well they were taken care of by looking at their teeth and things like that. So is that like an example of what you would do?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah. And especially the teeth are a wonderful example. What we eat really affects our teeth. And today we don't think about it too much because we have such good dental care. We brush our teeth. We go to the dentist. But if you go back 200 years, if you were living, for instance, in New York City where I do my research, which was a big sugar port, individuals were drinking so many liquids with sugar in them, they were getting cavities just all over their teeth. Whereas if you look in the South at a plantation where there's a lot of corn, you'll see a different pattern of tooth degeneration. And so we can look at mouths and see, you know, are they eating well? Are they taking care of their mouths? Are they eating sugar? Is there a lot of grit in their food that's wearing away their teeth? And, yeah, I don't particularly like looking at teeth. They're sort of gross, but they definitely give us a lot of information about how individuals live. And slaves and the lives that they had, we can read a lot of labor in their bones, a lot of that heavy work that they did or didn't do, depending on what position they held in that household.
Yeah, interestingly, I was at the dentist a week ago, just before I flew out here, and every time my dentist opens my mouth, he just like, wow, you had 2 cigarettes for breakfast and a chocolate bar, didn't you?
Yeah, you can tell so much from those mouths.
Yeah, here's another question. Here's a question I wondered as I'm thinking about the show today, and I wanted to make sure I asked this question. And I guess I'm thinking about some discussions I had at Michigan State with a very good friend of mine. She was an anthropologist. Okay, and she talked about, would study clothes. She was in the doctoral program then, and they were like looking at old photos and studying clothes. And from the pictures, you could get a sense of just the period, the year, the era or whatever, the historical, what's going on in a picture in a historical sense. So I had heard that, like when we watch movies today, like Queen Elizabeth, and they're looking all cool. I just watched the Oscar Wilde movie, and they're looking all clean and neat and beautiful and pretty. Is it true that they really didn't live that well, even in like the European royalty? And do you understand the question?
I do, yeah. I mean, I think it's an interesting question. It's not really my area of specialty, but it's definitely an interesting question about, you know, what we see depicted in images today, what we see in images in the past, and how we sort of combine those and try to interpret what we're seeing. When we look at, you know, portraits that have been painted or during the early days of photography, the pictures that individuals were taken, they were staging these moments to capture something very specific. And, you know, that doesn't necessarily reflect what was really going on. One of the things that in the work that I do in the 19th century, we turn a lot to things like political cartoons. They're going to depict a picture of life a little bit different than maybe a staged photograph or a staged portrait and give us a sense of what was going on. So, you know, we have to think about sort of the public perspective, you know, what they were trying to portray to the public as versus, you know, what life was really like. It's the same thing we do today. you know, TV shows don't necessarily accurately reflect what life is like for individuals. They portray a certain image of what we want to think life is like. But it's a very interesting question, and anthropology in general is very closely tied up with history. And the two go hand in hand when we try to reconstruct life, no matter what the time period is that we're looking into.
You mentioned 19th century, and then you mentioned political cartoons. Do you do any kind of work with the whole Thomas Nast thing?
Not specifically, no. That's not really my area. My specialty is more in, and specifically in New York City, and also looking at in children's lives and looking at the remains of children. The site that I'm doing my doctoral research on was a church cemetery that was used for about 20 to 30 years. And we've been going through and studying the remains, trying to determine what life was like for these individuals. And in particular, I've been looking at the children who didn't survive that time period and trying to get a picture of what childhood was like in New York City in the 19th century, which is a very interesting time to be alive. And also dangerous for young children. There's a lot of disease and a lot of challenges that are presented to them. So, yeah, that's more my area.
Okay. Which brings me to the next question. How did you get involved with bioarchaeology?
Sure. You know, I'm not sure I have an easy answer to that question. I think it's one of those things that, you know, as a little child, you read National Geographic and you watch the Discovery Channel and you get interested in archaeology. And I just sort of followed that interest through high school, through reading magazines like Archaeology Magazine, and then into college where I started taking a few classes. And it was really the woman that I took classes with in my undergraduate institution, Eileen Nicholas, who got me hooked on this field and this love of reconstructing how people lived and contributing to the historical record. And from there, you know, you just sort of follow your passions. And a few years ago, I ended up at SU, at Syracuse University, working in the field, and I just love it.
Okay, wow. So we're supposed, according to my producer, we're supposed to be talking about the Tappan project, the Tappan or
yeah.
Tappan?
Tappan.
Okay. How did you get involved with that? Well, what is the Tappan project, and how did you get involved?
Sure. So the Abolition Society in Peterborough, New York, the National Abolition Hall of Fame, every year or so, I actually don't know the exact spacing, but every few years, inducts a couple of historical figures into their society who were famous abolitionists or anti-slavery activists. Last year, they inducted Lewis Tappan, and this year they're commemorating him along with a few others like Theodore Dwight Wells this upcoming weekend at an event. And I'm going to be speaking about Lewis Tappan. And Lewis Tappan was an abolitionist in New York City in the early 1830s through the Civil War who worked to advocate for the immediate freedom for all slaves. At this point in time, by the 1830s, slaves in New York City had been freed, but many parts of the country still had slavery institutionalized. And he was a very religious man, and he believed that slavery and the treatment of human beings this way was a sin. And so he was working really hard to get these slaves freed. And how I came to be a part of this is Lewis Tappan was a very public figure. The site where I'm doing my research is less well-known and not terribly well-reported in the historical record. And in an attempt to find some history on the people whose remains I'm working on, I stumbled across his connection to their church. And it turns out they were working together to achieve this ideal society where slaves would be free and where there'd be racial equality, which is an interesting point. There are a lot of people advocating for the end of slavery, but not all of those people believed in racial equality. And Lewis Tappan and the folks who I'm studying really believed that all people were equal and should be treated as such. And that's a really neat thing, especially in the 1830s. That's a really great idea. So this weekend we're going to be celebrating Lewis Tappan and Theodore Dwight Weld and talking about their contributions to abolition and to our history.
Okay. What is the weekend celebration?
There are going to be a series of speeches in Peterborough, New York, where the National Abolition Hall of Fame is, and they're open to the public and free, and they're an opportunity to come and talk to some experts and hear about this field. and hear about these contributions. And then there's a celebratory dinner, and some banners are being unveiled to celebrate these individuals. So it should be a really interesting day for all of us to hear about these different individuals and what they've contributed.
You mentioned something about the remains you were working on.
Yes.
And this involves your current research, your doctoral studies research?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, tell me a little bit about that. I must have missed it.
Sure. So I'm working on a site that was a church in New York City in the first half of the 19th century. It actually lasted into the early 1900s. But during the first half of the 19th century, they had burial vaults, cemetery attached to their building. And they were burying bodies there for about 30 years before burial laws changed, and they were no longer able to do that. A few years ago, a construction project in New York City accidentally unearthed the cemetery. And by law, these remains have to be analyzed, and then they'll eventually be reburied or donated to a museum. In this case, we've been working on this project for about 4 or 5 years now. There are about 300 individuals who are buried at this site, and it was a church site, and the church leaders were active abolitionists who worked with Lewis Tappan. And so there are these really interesting individuals. We suspect that many of them came from working class or poor backgrounds, but they were all bound together along with these more middle class leaders in their belief of the abolition of slavery and racial equality. And so what we do is we go through and we examine each bone and each body and try to reconstruct what life was like for these individuals and can give back to this historical record of both New York City and the Presbyterian Church.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know how this question is going to sound, but I'm interested to know how long, because you said you analyzed these remains to see what life was like, et cetera. How long does that take?
It can take a very long time. It depends in part on how many people are working on this project. There are two of us at Syracuse University who are doing this. There are two people at Utica College who are working on it, and then a handful of volunteers, undergraduate students, and graduate students who come through and help as well. And there are 300 individuals, but these were not individual graves. These were wood coffins that had been stacked in underground vaults, and over time those wood coffins rotted and the skeletons sort of collapsed into each other. So we have a problem in that we think we have about 200 to 300 people, but they're all mixed up. So we can't just look at an individual body completely and do our analysis. We actually have to go through each bone. And with 300 people, it's hard to reconstruct them into individuals. So it's a very slow process. It's been about 4 or 5 years now. We have a couple more, hopefully ahead of us too, until we finish up. But it's well worth the time investment. I think it's really important that these people, since they had to come out of the ground, that we, you know, do them homage and remember them before they are reburied and go back into the ground that way.
So once you're done with your research and analysis, what happens to the remains? I mean, are they moved to another cemetery, or are they sent back to that cemetery that is being excavated? How does that go?
You know, that is up to the descendant population, the group that is acting as the descendants, and I don't really know what the decision has been or when it will occur. In these sort of situations, I can only speak generally and say that usually remains end up reburied. Now, the particular site where these were excavated from in New York City, there is a building built there now, so they won't be going back there. But as for their final destination, I'm afraid I just don't know. But it is probably likely that they will end up reburied. That's the respectful thing to do, I at least think. So.
Mm-hmm. You know why I asked that question? Because a lot of times when you're looking, even if it's in a book, an anthropology book, or you're looking on those forensic files, this might be a really silly question, but I'm sure somebody else is thinking it. They'll have bones lying around, and they'll have bones like in storage.
Sure.
And you're wondering, who is that?
Yeah. The bones that you see in those sort of things that are kept in storage are usually, and I'm not going to speak for all situations, but I know, for instance, the collection that we have at Syracuse University, it's a collection of remains from people who donated their bodies to science. So those people willingly donated to a medical college or to a department for further study. In other cases, you may have collections from prehistoric times that were, you know, accidentally unearthed, and those have remained around for study and haven't been reburied. But especially when you're dealing with remains from a historic time period, from the 1700s, 1800s, where they were purposefully buried in a churchyard, you know, it's often the respectful thing to do to go ahead and rebury those. So those people didn't intend to be research specimens. Whereas those who donate their body to science certainly anticipated that that would be the end result for them.
Wow. Okay, great. I'm noticing that although you're in the department, you're a doctoral student in the Department of Anthropology at Syracuse University, you're actually studying bioarchaeology. And what is the difference between anthropology and archaeology?
That's a great question. I don't get that very often. Anthropology is sort of a broad field, and it includes cultural anthropology, which is what I think a lot of people think about when they hear the term anthropology, and that's going out and studying different living cultures around the world. It includes archaeology, which is the study of past cultures. It includes linguistics, which is the study of language and culture. And it includes bioarchaeology or physical anthropology, which is the study of humans themselves. And that includes evolution. It includes studying primates, our closest living cousins, and it includes what I do, studying human remains. So anthropology is the umbrella, basically, that all of us fall under. And what holds us together is we're all interested in discussing culture. We're interested in discussing how lives are lived, what people believed in, and whether that's today or 200 years ago, it's that same theme that runs through our work that makes us all anthropologists, first and foremost.
Okay. You know, when I was in undergrad, I remember I took a biology course, and the first thing he said was, if you're religious, then you really don't want to get into this stuff, you should leave the class. And he goes into the spiel about the reason why religion was a great hoax. So what do you think about all of that, the whole, I don't know, Jesus Christ, the earth is people are 6,000 years old and stuff like that. And then you have the anthropology and archaeology that says that man is 6 million, 7 million years old.
Well, you know, it's an interesting question. I think it's one that a lot of anthropologists in all sorts of fields wrestle with. I think speaking as an anthropologist, my base is to say that there are a variety of religions worldwide and that they all exist for a reason and that we should be careful to respect and understand all of them. Personally, I am a religious person. I do not see any problem between holding religious beliefs and studying history and evolution and culture. I think that they're absolutely compatible. But it's certainly an interesting part of the human condition. And it's something in my work on this church site that is integral to what I'm doing. These people had very specific religious beliefs that affected how they lived their lives. And it affected everything from their work in abolition, their anti-slavery movement, but also the kinds of food that they ate. There were a lot of movements in the 19th century to eat very plain diets and how that would bring you closer to God. And that will negatively affect the body. So we really see religion through all strains of life, whether we're looking at skeletal remains, modern cultures, or our own lives. And I think it's important that we really keep that in mind and respect it as we do our research, that this is, you know, a real key to the human existence.
Wow. Yeah, that's interesting. So it doesn't, I don't know, because I don't have a religious agenda here in answer, asking these questions. But I always wondered, like even doctors, you know, medical doctors, you know, what does it mean for them to study humanity on one end or have the power to heal people and on the other end have religious sensibilities? I always wondered.
Yeah, I really think that they're not incompatible at all. I think that's, you know, that's just personally how you reconcile your day-to-day life. And people have struggled with that since the beginning of time, and I think it's an important part of our research and our practices.
Okay, great. I have another question here, and this one is from my producer, Leslie Gist. I don't know if it's Gist or Gist, really. I'll just take a guess and say Gist. Which specific event, place, took place that connected tapping to your research? And I think you already answered that, didn't you?
Can you say that again? Sorry, you cut out for a second there.
Which specific event took place that connected tapping to your research?
Sure, yeah. Here's sort of the story behind tying all these things together and what I'm going to be speaking about on Saturday. In 1834 in New York City, for 9 days, groups of individuals rioted, attacking African-American homes and businesses and abolitionist homes and businesses and churches in what's known as the Race Riot of 1834. And that race riot was set off by a couple of things that had been building up over the summer, many of which Lewis Tappan was directly involved in. He organized an anti-slavery week in May, a celebration of the emancipation of the slaves, a commemoration event for those in New York City during July. His brother, Arthur Tappan, who was also a famous abolitionist, invited a famous African-American preacher to join him in his pew at a white church. And the congregation really didn't like that. And the preacher actually stood up before them and asked the congregation to consider how white Jesus actually was, and perhaps Jesus was of a dark Syrian hue. And all of these things combined sort of set a city that was already in an economic depression with high inflation and low labor, set the city off. And for 9 days, individuals went from building to building, house to house, church to church, setting it on fire and destroying it. Tappan's home was broken into. All of his furniture was thrown in the street and set ablaze in a bonfire. The site where I do my research was attacked. The homes of the pastors were attacked. The church itself was almost nearly destroyed. And so it was this series of riots that sort of gave me a window into the beliefs of the individuals at the church, because they connected themselves directly with Tappan. And it's called the Race Riot of 1834, but other historians have actually called it the Tappan Riot because it was so directly connected to Lewis Tappan. And this was at the beginning of Lewis Tappan's career as an abolitionist. And I think in some ways it must have hardened his belief that slavery was evil and that people needed to work together to end this institution.
Mm-hmm. So was he in some way challenging the church and the clergy, the pastors and the preachers as well?
Absolutely. He was part of the Presbyterian Church at the time, of which there were several in New York City. He was challenging sort of longstanding beliefs, and he actually organized a group of churches to break away from the mainstream. It was called the Third Presbytery, and all of these churches were abolitionist churches. The site that I work on was part of that group. Lewis Tappan's church was part of that group. And the Third Presbytery, although it only lasted about 7 or 8 years, for a while it was an influential little group of churches that really was working hard to go out into the public, educate the public about slavery, educate about racial equality, and work together to fight against slavery in the South. He was going against the norm. He was going against what the middle class saw. He was going against what different labor groups, they weren't interested in having competition from free African Americans. He was going against the Southern plantation owners and their business. And he was really forging a new path that was a challenging one for him for most of his life.
And eventually, Tappan is the guy who goes on to defend the Amistad Africans.
That's correct. He's perhaps best known for that. In the 1840s, he organized the defense for the Amistad Africans. They're the ones who mutinied on a ship in Cuba. They had been taken from Africa there to be sold into slavery, ended up in New York and were arrested. And he organized their defense, and which they eventually won. And although he wasn't a lawyer himself, he knew what lawyers to get a hold of. And some historians have actually said he should have been a lawyer. He was so good at what he did in that case that, you know, he should have actually been a lawyer himself. And he really worked with them. His idea in setting them free was not just to free them from slavery, but also to bring them to a Christian faith. He was a very religious man, and that was always part of his agenda. And I think he had a good soul no matter what he was trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Wow, this was very interesting because I learned a lot, man. And it's unfortunate that we got to go I think we got a minute before the music, that cool Sade music comes in and cut us off. And but this is Meredith Ellis. She's a doctoral student at the Department of Anthropology. So when are you defending?
Oh, another year or two away at least.
Oh, you got plenty of time. A lot of lattes to go, right?
Yeah.
And we were talking about anthropology. And if it was 30 more minutes, I would have created an agenda to figure out that whole anthropology and religion thing. some personal interest of my own. But thank you for being here with us, Meredith.
You're welcome, and thanks for having me.
Okay, this is the Gist of Freedom, Gist or Gist, I'm going to figure that out, the Gist of Freedom show. We're signing off, and we will see you next week. Bye-bye.